Did you know we have completely ad-free early access to all of our episodes? Well, we do. Not only that, but we have dozens of bonus episodes waiting for you. Head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod, and you can check it out for 7 days absolutely free. That's patreon.com/ghosttownpod.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
The original Phantom. I'm Jason Horton.
I'm Rebecca Lieb.
And this is Ghost Town.
With over 400 performances of opera, dance, and music each year, Charles Garnier's Paris Opera, known as the Palais Garnier, is arguably one of the busiest cultural institutions in France, maybe even in Europe, and one of the most high-profile opera houses in the world. And yet, that's not what it's known for. The Palais Garnier has become larger than life, not for its own creative work, but for someone else's, inspired to immortalize the building's architectural failings, rumors, and dark reputation. Underground lakes, mysterious deaths, bones, and curses. It all takes place in the Palais Garnier, the inspiration for the classic novel, movie, and musical, Phantom of the Opera. In 1821, the French government decided it wanted a fancy new opera house. So in the meantime, a temporary building known as the Salle Le Pelletier was the interim opera house. But with the French Revolution, of course, lavish opera houses were like a pretty low priority. Until 1853, when the Second French Empire was established and new interest in fancy opera houses arose. Around this time, as well, the history of the Palais Garnier, starting with the Salle Le Pelletier, would begin to go from famous to notorious. There was an attempted assassination on Napoleon in front of the Salle Le Pelletier, which upped social currency, oddly enough, and added urgency, maybe, to a permanent opera house with security. By March of 1858, a new site was found, and by 1860, famed architect Rohault de Fleury completed the design for what he thought would be the crowning achievement of his career. But a woman named Marie Anne de Ricci Poniatowska had other plans. A mistress of Napoleon, she used her privileged position to get her husband, Count Alexander Colonna Walewski, hopefully I'm saying that right, appointed to Minister of State, and instead of Fleury designing the opera, the whole project pivoted and Napoleon held a design competition to select a new architect for what would be his Imperial Academy of Music and Dance. Applicants were given a month to submit entries, with 170 potential concepts to choose from. Along with their design, applicants were asked to submit a motto that kind of summarized the vibe of their idea. Among the entries was an unknown 35-year-old architect named Jean-Louis Charles Garnier, who submitted his plan with a line from an Italian poet. The line was, "Bramo assai poco spero." Definitely was not saying that correctly. In any case, in English it translates to, "Hope for much, expect little." Not exactly grand, but words from someone who just wanted to be in the mix, I'd imagine. And he was, making it by the skin of his teeth. The least favored of seven finalists selected to move on to the second phase of the competition. So what was phase two? For the second round, you had to whip up a detailed 58-page program of the design, and on May 29th, Garnier's project won. Everyone was shocked, even Garnier's own wife, who wrote that one judge of the competition thought Garnier's plan was, quote, "remarkable in its simplicity, clarity, logic, and grandeur." Though others felt his style was amateurish, confusing, and hard to pin down, it clicked for the right people. It felt to some to be reflective of what was happening in Paris, right then and there. Historian Andrew Ayers wrote Garnier's plan was, quote, "a giddy mixture of up-to-the-minute technology, rather prospective rationalism, exuberant eclecticism, and astonishing opulence." Garnier's opera encapsulated the divergent tendencies and political and social ambitions of its era. The opera would even be named after Garnier, which is a pretty big deal for a guy who had done nothing noteworthy up to this point. During its construction, the Palais Garnier had another issue. As the foundation was being built, workers hit an arm of the Seine, causing water to flood into the site from the river. It was impossible to remove all the water, so crews found a not-so-ideal solution: to contain the runoff Seine water in the building's basement, with a massive underground reservoir under a discrete vaulted ceiling, and slowly would pump the water out from there. In fact, Seine water is still being pumped out of the Palais Garnier today. They just kind of let it be a giant lake at the bottom of an opera house, pumping the water out when it got too crazy, too flooded. This strange building snag caught the attention of Gaston Leroux. Great French name, right? Leroux was kind of a loser. At one point, he hoped to be a lawyer, but he spent his inheritance gambling and, now bankrupt, weaseled his way into a low-end reporting job at a local paper, L'Echo de Paris, writing about both theater and crime. Kind of my ideal job. He began writing about the construction of the opera house and kept a writerly eye on the drama revolving around it. It would take about 15 years to complete and over 7.5 million francs. The new Third Republic of France actually had to borrow money from the Monte Carlo Casino to pay for the completion of the Palais Garnier. On December 12, 1874, the Paris Ballet danced on the pristine new floor of the stage, and 6 days later, a gigantic 7-ton bronze and crystal chandelier that Garnier had designed to look over the stage and seating was lit up for the first time. It was a truly magnificent piece of architecture, but unfortunately for Napoleon, he never got to see the finished product he had worked so hard to advocate for, as he had died a year earlier. But there was one guy who did see it, Gaston Leroux. Leroux reported on the Palais Garnier regularly, noticing the reputation that the building was getting. Stories of weird underground lakes, of secret tunnels all over the building, that Napoleon's assassination attempt at the temporary site had cursed the opera itself, as did the revolutionary uprising that stalled the build. But in May 1896, rumors would be reinforced by a real tragedy. During Act One of the opera Hell, a mysterious fire in the roof of the opera house melted through a wire holding a counterweight for the chandelier, causing Garnier's massive 7-ton light fixture to break free from its counterweights and crash down through the auditorium ceiling, injuring many and killing a concierge standing in the audience below. Garnier was much more upset over his gigantic light fixture than the death and injuries of his fellow Parisians, and said of the damaged chandelier, quote, "What else could fill the theater with such joyous life? What else could offer the variety of forms that we have in the pattern of the flames, in these groups and tiers of points of light, these wild hues of gold flecked with bright spots, and these crystalline highlights?" The death at the hands of Garnier's poorly designed chandelier inspired other haunted stories and rumors of someone messing with the theater. A phantom, some might say. Also, the artists at the theater themselves had developed a not-so-great, high-maintenance reputation. Travel from her hotel to the theater by limousine, which doesn't sound too crazy until you realize that her hotel was only 300 yards away. Another actor required a strange entourage of 7 assistants and a teddy bear. Still another said that her stage jewelry was too cold, demanding that her accessories be warmed nightly before her entrance on the stage. These types of stories aroused everyone's paranoia and superstitiousness. Most famously, soprano Lucienne Breva refused to go on stage until a concierge had uttered merde, the French equivalent of break a leg, in her presence. When the concierge happened to be gone one night at one of her performances, Breva insisted he send a telegraph with the word, which arrived minutes before the show opened. Reporting on this stuff was great for Leroux, who, at the turn of the century, began to have a fascination with mystery, loving the iconic works of Edgar Allan Poe, Arthur Conan Doyle, and most sources just say those two. In 1907, he retired from reporting and started a kind of hybrid publishing company and studio for writing books and adapting them into the budding industry of motion pictures. It was another leap of faith for the financially chaotic writer, one that would piss people off and also pay off. More after the break.
Hi, hello, how are you?
Hello.
How are you doing?
You doing okay?
Feeling spooky.
You got chills up your spine?
Or not at all.
Or you're just sleeping late?
Yeah.
Just fine, just going about your existence?
Just watching Judge Judy.
Wow.
Eating cookies. who's that? Maybe that's
spooky.
Me. That might be me, yeah.
Wow.
We want to say hello to anyone who's listening.
Hello.
Spreading the good word of Ghost Town. Mm-hmm. We thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We hope you're having a spooktacular month.
We do. Very much so.
Yeah, we hope you're having a great Rocktober.
Yeah.
I said it.
Great Rocktober to you and yours.
And nothing rocks harder than the ghost town government.
Mm-mm.
They rock.
Mm-mm.
They love to rock.
They do. They rock and roll all night long.
Especially the mayors. they love to rock. And this rocker goes to bed at 9:30 p.m.
Holy
sharp.
Shit.
Yes. P.M.
That's so late.
Post-meridian.
Wow. That's, I mean, that's almost fucking 10.
It's almost 10. It's not quite 10. They're not, damn, they're not like on the brink.
Yeah. No, they're not going nuts.
But they're close. It's Cat Joselle.
Hello.
This no rules rock star loves to rock. Tax is done 3 months early.
Damn.
Or even the IRS is like, can you relax for 2 seconds? Come on.
We're busy.
Yeah.
We don't need to.
Yeah, we're not even that uptight
take
about
a
this.
Break.
Kelly Meehan.
Hello.
This rock and roll hero loves to party the rock and roll lifestyle. Throwing in an extra scoop of fiber.
Oh, shit.
In their
bad boy alert.
In their fiber shake.
Mm.
Just to keep things on the reg. That's Matthew Clemenz Leray.
Hello.
Now, this rock star, epic rocker, loves to rock. Cruising in, doing 66 and a 65.
Shit, that's above the speed limit.
Try to keep up, but it probably goes down to 65 once they realize the gravity of the situation.
Oh, damn.
It's Ashley Mattson.
Hello.
This rock and roll party animal just gets on the phone and reports that there's too much noise next door.
Wow.
And it's just the sound of somebody watching HBO's Westworld a little too loud.
Wow. There's nothing more rock and roll than a noise ordinance.
That'd be Emma Hopkins.
Hello.
And can't even talk about the history of rock and roll without talking about our governor.
Absolutely not.
Pulling the strings,
mm-hmm,
making the rules.
Mm-hmm.
People are signing with their souls.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
They're like, I don't know, how about a one album deal? And if you're like, you don't want to get out of it? Okay, no problem. Yeah, it's cutthroat.
One album deal. Yeah.
And if you want to keep going, let's keep going. But if not, no big deal. I would just hope that you're happy with your music and your art. Mm. So when they said like you're signing a pact with the devil,
mm-hmm,
that would be our governor,
Avian Noble.
If you want no ads, no chit chat, bonus episodes, got one coming up for Halloween, just the good stuff. Head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod. I was on a podcast and I used to talk about myself, like my history and what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done that in a really long time. And when you do it after not doing it for a while, you're like, oh, wow, a lot of time has gone by.
Oh, no.
But I was on Successful Failure podcast with my friend Jesse, kind of through stand-ups. He's a lot of stand-up.
Cool.
Somebody has other people. So we talked about stand-up, which is like relatively new again for me in the last few years. But then I went all the way back talking about Ghost Town, talking about us just rocking and rolling.
We did. We rocked and we rolled.
All our rock and roll. There's a video if you want to see me holding onto a microphone like I'm holding on for dear life.
Dear goddamn life.
Check out the Successful Failure podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and on the Instagram. Mm. And I'm sure I'll share it out on my Instagram. So if you want to hear about me going through a full blown midlife crisis,
every detail.
Yeah, nothing spared. Check that out.
Ooh, that sounds very intriguing.
Got anything more highbrow for us?
Yeah, we got to get back to the highbrow stuff. Let's get back to Paris post-French Revolution, where, for his first foray into the world of being a professional writer and producer, Gaston Leroux is trying his hand at writing his own hard-boiled detective novels. The first one he wrote was called The Mystery of the Yellow Room, and it was one of the first locked room mysteries, so, you know, a mystery that takes place in one room. Everybody loved it, including a young Agatha Christie, who showered praise on LaRue and was inspired herself to maybe try her hand at the genre. Even today, I was reading reviews of The Mystery of the Yellow Room, and people still praise its creativity, its engaging storyline. It was very successful. Of course, the mostly down-and-out LaRue had finally found some success, so the dude had to write a follow-up. His next novel will be a thoughtful departure from a psychological mystery with riddles and courtroom confrontations to something highly gothic, dramatic, macabre, feeding into the rumors and reporting he had done about the Palais Garnier. At that point, Palais Garnier's rumor mill was more active than ever. Was it haunted? Did someone live there? Was it doomed, cursed, or preying on those who spend a considerable amount of time inside? Was there a network of secret passageways for those in the know to traverse? 4 years after the mystery of the Yellow Room, LaRue took these ideas and ran with them, writing Le Fantôme de l'Opéra, a serialized story published in newspapers and then as a book in 1910, The Phantom of the Opera. Now that you may know a bit more about the Palais Garnier, you probably realize that LaRue was kind of ripping off, or inspired, however you want to frame it, directly from the building. The setting of The Phantom of the Opera is the actual Palais Garnier. There's a lake underneath in the book where a mysterious figure lives. A chandelier literally falls onto the audience. The Phantom himself was inspired by a pianist LaRue researched, a man who was disfigured after the 1873 fire at the Palais Garnier's precursor, again the Salle Le Pelletier, and also from an assistant to Garnier who mysteriously disappeared during the Palais Garnier's construction. He was also inspired by the tale of Romantic composer Carl Maria von Weber, who, while staging his opera Der Freischütz, the Freeshooter, in 1841 at the good old La Salle des Pelletiers, he used a real human skeleton as a prop. According to the source F. de l'Opera, here's the story behind the skeleton. Quote, there was a young man who willed his bones to the old opera house, La Salle des Pelletiers. This young man, Beau Maison, was a member of the Corps de Palais, and he fell in love with a ballerina, Nanine Dorival, who was also in the opera's ballet. Incidentally, like Megan the Phantom, Dorival's mother was also a boxkeeper. However, Dorival had another suitor, Mr. Moserier, lots of French names, sorry if I'm pronouncing them incorrectly, a sergeant major in the French army, who decided to teach Beau Maison a lesson. One night, when Beau Maison came to confront him, Moserier had three of his officers tie Beau Maison up and leave him in the peristyle of the opera, where he spent the night. Due to exposure to the elements, Beau Maison developed a bad fever and died, but not before making a single request. Beau Maison bequeathed his body to the opera's doctor in hopes that his skeleton would be kept at the opera near to his beloved, even in death. And also at this point, a lot of these places had doctors because a lot of things happened. Women gave birth to babies. People had heart attacks. There was a lot going on. It was very exciting. So that was not unusual. According to the legend, though, Beau Maison's skeleton was indeed kept at the opera, where it eventually was used on stage as a prop in the second act of Le Freischütz, the Freeshooter. Though this skeleton given to the opera house story was debunked, though it was a real skeleton, I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me, it does seem to parallel the love triangle between the Phantom, Raoul, and Christine. Quote, LaRue took all of these stories and he created one of the most important stories of the 20th century, said Isabel Rochelle Costa, author of the work of Obscure Clarity and The Phantom of the Opera by Gaston LaRue. And the world agreed. LaRue had published a total of 6 books before writing The Phantom, but almost immediately, the work eclipsed them all. A tragic, gothic love story with poetry, ghosts, and art, all perfectly set in a beautiful, mysterious, unforgiving theater. LaRue's novel was made into 2 silent films, much to his delight. His own film studio had never quite gotten off the ground, and he was excited by the emerging genre of entertainment. The first silent film, released in 1916, was a German adaptation called Das Gespenst im Opernhaus. Unfortunately, you can't watch it. The film was lost along with almost 75% of other movies of the silent era. The next was in 1925 by Universal Studios, with Lon Chaney as the Phantom. Sadly, LaRue was not able to see the Universal adaptation. He died in 1927. But the most famous adaptation of the novel is probably the one that you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber's 1986 musical, The Phantom of the Opera. This deeply romantic, over-dramatic version of LaRue's text was faithful to the book but bigger, using real-life accounts of the falling of the chandelier and reporting on the opera's long history. Andrew Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera would run on Broadway for 35 years, becoming the longest-running musical before closing in 2023, this year. But don't worry, it still plays in London as the second-longest-running West End musical behind Les Miserables. Today, according to a New York Times article about the Palais Garnier, many are pretty unsure where the opera house's history ends and LaRue's story, The Phantom of the Opera, begins. Pierre Vidal, curator of the Palais Garnier's museum and library, gets asked all the time if the story of The Phantom of the Opera is true. Quote, we don't like to break the illusion, he says, but no one has seen a ghost in the opera house. Although we do blame the Phantom as a joke if something inexplicable happens. That being said, there's no denying the innate creepiness of what happened there. I mean, there's still an underground lake beneath the Opera House today, one that is regularly used for training French firefighters to swim in the dark. In the lake, reservoir more specifically, there are these large, smoky white catfish that I read about that swim by the open grates, kept alive by Palais Garnier's staff. Ghosts or phantoms, maybe not in the traditional sense, but the fish are something, all of it adding to the dark pedigree of arguably the world's strangest and definitely most notorious opera house.
History is full of bizarre, unsolved mysteries. And over time, these stories have been bent by rumor, warped by social media, and twisted into legend. I'm Michael May, and on A Study of Strange, we dig into these real mysteries and seek the truth, as close as we can get anyway. Recently, we've covered true crime cases like the Greystone Mansion murder, the Red Lipstick Killer, and America's first reported serial killers. Of course, every now and then we also dive into the odd, esoteric, and paranormal, including vanishing people, haunted locations, and UFO history. So if you like your mysteries historical, or if you love a good debunking every now and then, search A Study of Strange wherever you listen to podcasts. And remember, the truth is always stranger than fiction.